homes of some of our older folks and just bless them with some Christmas songs. And then we'll come back here for a time of fellowship. Bring your favorite Christmas cookies or Christmas treats. We'll have some hot cocoa and we'll warm up that way. How many of you are hoping for a white Christmas? Just a dusting? A snow on Christmas morning that melts by the next day. Ralph says no. Yeah, I don't mind the snow. What we get around here that's really fun is ice. Ice that knocks the power out. I remember back in 07 or 08 when I was in Oklahoma, there was a huge ice storm. I think you guys got hit with the same one here. It was 07. We had people in the area that were without power for 2 weeks. You know, and it's a bad deal for those folks, but it's not like all the power was out everywhere. It was spotty. I remember a time when I was in high school and our whole city lost power. And it was just really freaky driving through town, and there wasn't any lights anywhere, no stoplights. You could see every star in the sky. Now imagine that the lights go out and they don't come back on. Darkness. No light. Josh is going to tell me I'm getting too far out here. I do this just to keep him on his toes. But there's no light. And unlike when the light goes out for a storm or something, it doesn't come back on in 5 minutes or an hour or whenever Terry's guys can get around to getting it back up. Imagine it doesn't come back on. And the minutes turn into hours, the hours into days, and the days into weeks and months and years. This is how the Bible describes what it was like in the southern kingdom of Judah in the 8th century B.C. during the ministry of Isaiah the prophet. Now, no, Israel hadn't run out of olive oil for their lamps. And no, there wasn't a miraculous eclipse that blocked the light of the sun. What he was describing was what things were like politically and economically and spiritually in the land. Politically, they had sought the help of wicked allies who had betrayed them and now threatened to destroy them. In fact, the armies of the Assyrians had already come marching in from the north and had wiped out the northern kingdom of Israel. Their capital, Samaria, had fallen. Israel was no more, sent away into captivity. Those 10 tribes, never to be heard from again. And now the armies of the Assyrians were beating at the gates of Jerusalem. Economically, the picture is just as bleak. In those days when kings would set off to war, you could respond in one of two ways. You could get your own armies and you could go out to meet them in battle and decide things that way. Or you would get several of your officials or whatever, dignitaries, and you would send tribute. Sort of like the ancient version of mafia protection money, if you will. Well, King Hezekiah in Jerusalem tried that very thing. He sent a tribute of 20,000 pounds of silver and 2,000 pounds of gold. And to do that, he had to empty both the temple treasury and the royal treasury. In fact, they had to strip all of the gold from the doorposts of the temple. So as you can imagine, the budget was pretty tight in Jerusalem. Archaeologists have uncovered records kept by King Sennacherib of Assyria, where he brags that they had destroyed 46 cities in Judah. He describes Jerusalem as trapped like a caged bird. They destroyed crops. They cut down the flocks and livestock. There was no trade in or out of the city. It was a time of darkness in the land. And the closing verses of the previous chapter in Isaiah 8 describe it as a time where they do not have the light of dawn. No, the sun isn't coming up tomorrow. There isn't going to be the light of a new day. Verse 22 says they see only distress and darkness and fearful gloom or the dimness of anguish. That phrase really grabs me. The dimness of anguish. Because there is no darkness darker than the dark night of the soul. And chapter 8 ends by saying that they will be thrust into utter darkness. Dark darkness, if you will. And when you start talking about that kind of darkness, and you start considering this dimness of anguish, I don't think this is just a description of 8th century Judah. I think sometimes it's a description of our own lives. Our own hearts. Our own dark nights of the soul. Because hasn't your journey taken you to some very dark places? I know mine has. Who here hasn't journeyed through the valley of the shadow of death? I did a funeral for the Nice family just this week. They are journeying through that dark valley. And the darkness of the grave is pretty bleak. Maybe darkness has swallowed you whole as you felt helpless, as your marriage fell apart. Or as you watched your child's life skid off the rails. And as much as you tried to help, but as much as you tried to stop it, you couldn't. And you looked for any ray of light, but all you could see were shades of darkness. Or maybe it's just the darkness of your own choices and foolish mistakes. And each choice you made took you deeper and deeper into the shadows. And you finally reach a point where you turn around and you look back and you realize you can't see any light at all. Maybe for you it's the pitch black of addiction. And you are so firmly in its clutches that you can no longer even see light between its claws. And wherever your dark place is, there you experience a total eclipse of your soul. And then comes Isaiah chapter 9, verses 1 through 7. And it's a dazzling display of light for all who have found themselves in a very dark place. And you see, our text in Isaiah 9 opens with a glimmer of hope. The darkness will not last forever. There will be a new day, a new dawn. In the darkness, the prophet tells us something wonderful. In verse 2, it says, the people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. And so we begin our journey to the manger. And I know this doesn't sound too Christmassy. Not yet. We're talking about military history and political intrigue. It's kind of a curious way to kick off the season. But then we remember just what this light is. You see, this is the passage that Matthew uses when the angel makes his announcement to a very confused Joseph. It's also the same passage that Matthew uses as Jesus begins his earthly ministry. You see what this is? It's a birth announcement written 700 years ahead of time. You know, we usually wait till somebody's pregnant before we send out birth announcements. God does it hundreds of years in the future before it happens. I think the Apostle John may have also been thinking of these very words when he opened his account of Jesus' life, in part with these words. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. And so over these next four Sundays, we're going to make our journey to Bethlehem. And we take our first steps this morning as we look at Isaiah's prophecy of a brilliant light shining in the darkness. And over these next three Sundays, we will journey into the stable to worship not just a baby lying in the manger, but a victorious king who brings wonderful light into your darkest of places, even the shadows of your souls. These next three Sundays are also the perfect time for you to invite your friends, neighbors, co-workers, family. You see, Christmas is a time of year that when people who often don't have room for God or the church in their lives might be willing to make a little extra space. And so this is a good chance for them to come hear the good news of great joy. And I really want to encourage you to invite your friends over these next few weeks. Now, our passage opens with a promise to the area around the Sea of Galilee. Verse 1 reads, "Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who were in distress. In the past, He humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, but in the future, He will honor Galilee of the nations by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned." Now, we all know that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, which is down south in Judah. But where did He grow up? He grew up in Nazareth, up north, in Galilee. That was the land that He called home. That's where He grew up. That's where He first began His ministry. He performed His first miracles there. It was there He first pronounced the kingdom of God that would reign in the hearts of men and women that loved and followed Him. It was this area that was also the very first area to fall to the Assyrians when they invaded. You see, when they came down from the north. And so the tribes of Naphtali and Zebulun were amongst the first to be overwhelmed in darkness. And in the very first land to fall to the darkness, the light would first shine. And what is that light? Look at verse 6. "For to us a child is born. To us a son is given, and the government will be on His shoulders, and He will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the greatness of His government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over His kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Almighty will accomplish this." Now that sounds a little bit more Christmassy, doesn't it? We've heard those words at Christmas time before. "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given." Well, I want to take just a few minutes this morning and consider from these verses how Jesus brings light to our deepest, darkest places. And the first thing we need to see is the light of His hope. The coming of Jesus brings hope. Because when you are in the dark, nothing lifts your spirit like a light. Now, the word hope isn't used anywhere in this passage, but I think it's positively dripping with hope. We see it there in the promise of verse 2. "The people walking in darkness have seen a great light." And this isn't just a flickering match or a dollar store flashlight. This is a great light. After a long, hard night, a new day is dawning. There is new light. And hear the hope overflowing in these words. "You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before You as a people rejoice at harvest, as warriors rejoice when dividing the plunder. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, You have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. Every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire." The children of God have seen their land divided. They have seen their borders shrink as the armies of the Assyrians come in. However, Isaiah tells of a time when the nation will be enlarged. It will grow. Their joy will be increased, and it will be a time of rejoicing like after a bountiful harvest. They're going to throw a party like after a great lopsided victory. In fact, Isaiah recalls to their minds one of the most lopsided victories in their history. You can read all about it in Judges chapter 7. God takes a man by the name of Gideon and only 300 men, and they completely rout the armies of the Midianites. Total victory. And he says it's going to be a party like that. In fact, he says, no longer will you be in servitude to other nations. You'll be able to draw down your military. You won't need your arms anymore. They'll be able to burn their battle clothes. There'll be an end to the fighting and bloodshed. Peace at last, there is hope. Now, Assyria would never capture Jerusalem. God would miraculously deliver them from the hands of the Assyrians. During the night, an angel would slay 185,000 Assyrians. That's a lot of dead soldiers. That's more than the entire population of Springfield. That's a pretty big army, and that's just the dead ones. And this mass death of Assyrian troops is a fact of history. I did some reading this week. An ancient Babylonian historian named Berossus records that a pestilence broke out in the army camp. Greek historian Herodotus tells of field mice scurrying about the camp and chewing at the leather of the Assyrian weapons, rendering them useless. Modern historians suppose that maybe a bad case of cholera or some other waterborne illness hit the army because King Hezekiah had blocked off all of the safe water sources in the area. Whatever means the angel used, God delivered Jerusalem from an overwhelming force. And Judah would experience a time of resurgence and revival under King Hezekiah, although it's doubtful that that time of resurgence fulfills these promises. First of all, Israel would never again reach the level of prominence that she had enjoyed under David and Solomon. King Hezekiah's resurgence never did include the area around Galilee. And so, there are some scholars that feel, well, these promises are conditional promises that Israel lost because she rejected Jesus as their Messiah. Others believe these promises are still to be fulfilled at some point in Israel's future. Maybe during a millennial kingdom. Others say, no, there's a spiritual fulfillment. As God enlarges His people by making peace between Jew and Gentile and bringing those of every nation, of every tribe, of every language, of every race, and bringing them together and making peace between them as a part of His church. And the peace that He brings isn't a military peace or a political peace, but it's a spiritual peace where people finally have peace with their God and peace with each other and peace inside as they are at one with themselves. And it's an eternal peace that we can enjoy forever. But there's this thing about biblical prophecy. A lot of biblical prophecy seems to be pointing to two things at once. It's kind of like quantum physics, where in quantum mechanics, an electron can actually be in two places at one time. Maybe a simpler illustration would be, if I am pointing back here. Now, am I pointing at the back of the room? Maybe I'm pointing at the doors? Or maybe I'm pointing out the window to something happening in the field on the other side of the street. And when a prophecy points its finger, a lot of times there's something very near in the future that's in view, but then there is a greater spiritual fulfillment on the distant horizon. And I think there may be some earthly promises to Israel here that are in the foreground, But I think on the big mountain on the horizon here is definitely the coming of Jesus and the peace that passes understanding that He gives to all who love and follow Him. Ultimate peace is not found in treaties. It's not found in alliances. True lasting peace cannot be achieved through military might or diplomatic maneuvers, but only by having a relationship with your Creator. That's true peace. We all have times that we walk in darkness. In the bleak shadows of our souls, we have no peace. But Jesus brings His light to those dark corners and He gives us hope. And the hope that He gives dispels the shadows of broken relationships, of broken dreams, and of broken promises. He fills our hearts with hope. And this is no Disney fairy tale, wish upon a star kind of hope. This is the hope of a sure thing. Notice how many of these verses are written in the past tense. The people have seen a great light. You have enlarged the nation. In fact, in the Hebrew, this whole passage is written in the past tense. God's vision of the future is written as a thing that's already happened. That's how sure this is. It's not a, well, maybe, perhaps. No, this is a done deal. And when you give your heart to Jesus, you're not just throwing your spiritual coins into the heavenly fountain and wishing for the best. No. You are finding the light of a sure and certain hope. And it isn't just the light of His hope that dispels the darkness from our hearts. It's also the light of His humanity. Now, at first, that might sound a little confusing and not so reassuring. Wait a minute. You mean God is coming in human form as one of us? I told Anna I might come and grab her baby just to use that as an illustration during this part of the sermon, but I don't want to run the risk of waking him up and making him cry. That would kind of take away from my point. But yes, not only is He coming in human form, He's coming as a child. For to us a child is born, a son is given. Now how do you package a mighty God as a little baby? And how was that to bring hope to the Judeans crushed under the boot of the mighty Assyrian army? How is that to bring them hope? How are the dreaded armies of the Assyrians, tens of thousands strong, threatened in any way by the birth of a helpless baby infant? Maybe they should talk to Herod the Great. He was willing to kill a whole bunch of infants because he felt threatened. But God's deliverance often comes from the most surprising of sources. Consider, if you will, Daniel. A 14-year-old kid whisked away from his home, taken into captivity, and forced into the king's service. And he asked to go on a special diet. So God begins to move. Or consider Joseph, a slave, falsely accused, rotting in prison, and he has a funny dream. And so it begins. Or how about Ruth? A foreign widowed refugee picks grain from a certain man's field. And in so doing, she becomes part of our Lord's genealogy. Or how about Esther? A slave girl in the king's harem asks the king a question at dinner time. And from such small sources, God changes history. God's hope often comes from the direction you would least expect it. And I think if we had time this morning, we could get into small groups and we could just share about times and stories from our own lives where God's help came in a shape and a size and from a direction that we never thought it would come. But it did. It turns out God in the flesh is exactly what you and I need. We didn't need an angel. We didn't need a God in spirit form, but we needed Emmanuel, God with us, as one of us, to see what we see, to feel what we feel, to face the same trials and temptations that we do. We didn't merely need merely God declaring what we needed, but we needed God demonstrating it. You see, a light with us helps us see much better than a light shown at us. A light with us illuminates. A light at us only blinds. A few years ago, when I was learning to hunt, I'd read all about it. I watched all these YouTube videos. But there was a guy in my church named Frank who took me out in the woods. And he showed me. And he was there with me. And he did it for me. And he walked with me through it and showed me how to do it. And he shed more light than on anything I read or watched. What we needed was more than commandments etched in stone, more than a prophet with words from on high. But we needed God to stand in our place, to show us, to do it for us, to walk with us through it, to be the light so we could see. In Hebrews chapter 2, it tells us that Jesus is not ashamed to call us brothers and sisters because He shares in our humanity. He shares in our flesh and blood. And our text says that this Son wouldn't just come or that He would be born. It says to us, a Son is given. He was a gift. He was not ours to demand or earn or take. But He was God's to give. And so Jesus was sent. He was given. He was heaven's gift. So there is the light of His hope, the light of His humanity, and there is the light of His honor. And honor is probably not the best word to use here, but I'm a preacher and I needed an H word to fit with the other two H words. But I think honor does kind of capture this idea of majesty and glory and power that we see later on in this text. He may have come as a child, but verse 6 ends by telling us that this Son will be able to take the government on His shoulders. Now, Isaiah's original audience probably hears that phrase a little differently than we do. I mean, we're redneck rural Americans, and we hear government and we think, you know, bureaucracy and needless regulations and all this sort of thing. And that's not what that's talking about. But this is talking about the rule or the reign of Jesus. I found one translation that worded it here, His princely power. This refers to the royal reign of Jesus. You see, He wasn't just a baby. He wasn't just the Son of Man, but He was the Son of God. And somehow, some way, all of the power of mighty God was put into that tiny, frail, fragile human package. And what those in power could never do for us, He is able to take upon His shoulders and do Himself. Politicians may promise peace, but they never deliver, at least for long. Neville Chamberlain, who was Prime Minister of England at the beginning of World War II, in probably what is considered one of the greatest acts of appeasement in history, signed a non-aggression pact with Hitler. And when he returned to England, he held a piece of paper and he had declared that he had achieved peace for our time. Peace didn't last very long. A few years ago, Secretary of State John Kerry returned home with an agreement with Iran. How well is that working out? July 27, 1953, an armistice was signed with North Korea. It was designed to, quote, ensure a complete cessation of hostilities and all acts of armed force in Korea until a final peaceful settlement is achieved. Have we found a final peaceful settlement? No. Do you want final, lasting peace? Look at our text. Of the greatness of His government, His princely rule, and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over His kingdom, establishing it and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The only government that brings true peace to our lives is not the legislation of anyone in Washington, but it's only the royal rule of Jesus in your heart. And our hope doesn't come from the White House in Washington or the United Nations in New York or any other hall of human power, but only in the honor of Jesus Christ as He lights our hearts with His love. His throne is the throne of our hearts. It is the throne of heaven where one day we will reign with Him in the new Jerusalem, in the new heavens and the new earth. And His rule will be complete. His reign will be perfect. Everything will be just and right. And I don't think this prophecy is pointing to any future thing in Jerusalem. I don't think it's pointing to any millennial reign, because this is a reign that lasts forever. It never ends. See, ultimately, this prophecy isn't talking about any earthly government. This is an eternal peace, an everlasting righteous rule. And it's a rule that can begin right now, today, in your hearts and in your lives, when you decide to follow Jesus. He is a light in the darkness. He is your light in your darkness. No matter what that darkness is. Do you know Him? Do you love Him? Do you follow Him? You see, for the confused and wandering soul, He's a wonderful counselor. For the weak and defenseless, He's a mighty God. For the abandoned and fatherless, He's an everlasting Father. For the wounded and hurting, He's the Prince of Peace. You need light in your darkness? You need Jesus.